Wallace, explain to us the electric universe. What is that?
Well, basically, it says that the electric force is the strongest force in the universe, and it is the only force you need. All of the other forces, the magnetic force, gravitational force, and the nuclear force, can all be explained in terms of that single force. So it simplifies our picture of the universe. The other thing is that we all know that electricity is very useful. You know, we can run electric motors, we can light our homes and so on and heat them. And we do this by generating power at some distance away from our cities and then transferring that power to the cities. Now, what I've found is that the universe does the same thing. It transfers power from one region to another. It creates galaxies and then lights them. The stars, in effect, are like streetlights running along the power lines. And it means that you end up with a coherent and simple picture of the universe. It's one that engineers can understand. It doesn't require any esoteric mathematics or any invented matter, black holes, all these kinds of strange things which sounds like science fiction actually return to the realm of science fiction.
Do you believe that this electric universe could provide us with power for virtually no cost if we could tap into it, as some have thought?
Yes, I think so. Once we understand the real electrical nature of matter, we will find ways of gently nudging that power out of the nucleus instead of using what I would term brute force and ignorance. You know, extremely high temperatures, trying to smash atoms together and so on. It seems to me that nature knows how to tap that energy without being destructive. And once we learn that lesson, we will have limitless power.
David, as a mythologist, you've looked at, I'm sure, ancient texts, and you've come up with some of your own interpretations. Are you familiar with some of the work of Zachariah Sitchin?
I am. I've met him. I enjoyed him a lot. He was one of the featured speakers at the 1997 conference in Portland, Oregon, where Wall and I were sharing the stage with others. And it has been very clear to me that many people who have taken an interest in Zachariah Sitchin are interested in our work as well. George, they're not completely compatible hypotheses, but there are areas of overlap.
I was going to say, what do you think of the way he interpreted the Sumerian texts?
I find it almost impossible to accept the interpretation of the gods of ancient Sumer as astronauts. And this is because of the comparative approach that I've worked with. I just remember picking up one of his books. This was like 30 years ago, but I had been deep into this study already, and I remember his identification of the Sumerian god Enlil as a kind of intelligent being in space. But I had found beyond any reasonable doubt that Enlil was essentially the same mythological figure as the Egyptian Shu. I mean, there's a very definitive character there having to do with a column, a luminous column between the earth and the sky, and the great mountain, the great pillar of heaven. These two figures are so identical in their relationships to other mythological figures, and the god Shu was most certainly not an astronaut. So I was just taking my work in the direction of identifying the relationship between mythological figures and the celestial forms that are implied by the text, very directly implied by the text. They are not astronauts.
He has written, though, about Earth colliding with another object.
There you go.
Yeah. And, you know, strangely enough, scientists are checking out this huge gash in the crust on the planet, which might have been caused by a collision.
I'm not sure which planet you're
Us, planet Earth. They've got this part of the crust they find is gone.
Yeah. I think Wall may have some things to say about that, but what you've identified there is the ground for common interest between our work and the large number of followers of Sitchin. Yes.
How would he know that there was a collision? How would these ancient texts know?
Well, I don't know if they would know anything about a gash in the Earth, because I don't know when that would have formed. I can tell you this: there is a very exciting mythological story of the formation of the Valles Marineris on Mars, because that huge gash appears on the face of that planet as a great scar. And Ralph Jurgens, the engineer who first formulated the electrical scarring hypothesis of planets and moons, he said, that's the scar of an electric arc. It's definitively so. And I was working along a completely different line of investigation, and I found the Scarface motif related to the Cosmic Warrior. He ends up in this horrific cosmic battle, and he emerges from it with this stupendous scar on his face, and it was caused by a thunderbolt. So there is, around the world, in the Scarface motif, a basis for believing that the scar of Mars was actually formed in a cataclysmic electrical exchange between Mars and another body very close to the Earth, witnessed by humanity. There's a lot of other evidence that has to be incorporated into any argument in this direction, such as the meteorites that have fallen on Earth from Mars.
All right,
the red dust that has fallen on Earth from Mars. The evidence that Mars was an immense source of meteoric and asteroidal and comet material due to electrical exchanges that occurred. Wall has invested a lot of time in examining the Valles Marineris, and when he was in Portland in 96-97, I said, okay, Wall, is there any possibility that the Valles Marineris was caused by a cosmic thunderbolt? And I related the Scarface theme, the scar being caused by a cosmic thunderbolt, and he said, well, it is the scar of a cosmic thunderbolt, and he showed me slides, and it was very convincing.
The thunderbolt, which would cause the scarring, kind of paint a picture for us, David or Wallace. Yeah. If one were on the planet watching it, witnessing it, what would it look like?
It would be absolutely overpowering. If you could imagine a giant corkscrew coming down out of the sky, a blinding flash, it would hit the center of the Valles Marineris, the place where the valleys are widest, and then spread across the surface in the form of those huge valleys and the chaotic terrain at the either end. And then it would curve upwards in the east and downwards in the west in the shape of a barred spiral galaxy. The reason for that is that one of the most powerful discharge phenomena in the universe is the spiral galaxy. And so if you have a sufficiently powerful plasma discharge, it will take that form, and that's precisely what you see on Mars.
Is it done in an instant, or does it take time?
Well, you have to scale things up. Something that size would be more than just a lightning flash. It would probably last for hundreds of seconds, or a few minutes maybe.
Just carving its way out.
Yes.
And littering the Martian landscape with boulders sharply cut rocky debris. And that is exactly what we see across the whole face of the planet. And part of the issue here is, if it isn't an electrical scar, and all the evidence does point in that direction, well, what is it? Planets don't just rest there and then suddenly open up with this huge gash.
Yeah, they don't crack like an egg.
The scientists had originally said, well, it was cut by water, some kind of flash flood yet unexplained. But when they really looked closely, they had to abandon that. They had only one thing left, and that was a tear or a rift. But a rift will tend to be at least as deep as it is wide. The Valles Marineris, it is a few miles, let's say 3 or 4 miles deep, depending where you
look. It goes up to about 9 kilometers deep.
It's over 300 miles wide.
No, water wouldn't do that. I don't think.
And nor would a rift. You see, I mean, how would the surface get moved 325 miles apart? It really is a scar without explanation until you allow for the possibility that that planet was, not all that long ago, completely engulfed in electric discharge.